want to see the team have the kind of fight that they had in 2016, even if we shock the world. Shock the world!
We're playing a Mexican team in the next round.
That's what I was about to say.
Howard and forward, Jack Price in goal.
And the Colorado Rapids, the team from the Rockies, have scaled their own mountain tonight. They are MLS Cup winners.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to another episode of Holding the High Line with Rabbi and Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We are recording this on the evening of Wednesday, May 16th, 2018, in the midst of all of the crazy Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup action in the second round proper, as well as in the midst of the Vancouver Whitecaps hosting the San Jose Earthquakes. Rabbi Mark Goodman, you are out in Pittsburgh. How go the River Hounds?
They won tonight over Erie, the Erie Commodores, who have a super dope crest, which is like a giant clipper ship in yellow and blue. They won 2-1, but the game wasn't streamed. I had to listen to it on the radio. And other than that, Pittsburgh is fun. We went and looked at a school for my kids. Tomorrow we go look at a house. And the craziest thing from today was going to the supermarket. You really feel like you're in a totally alien country or world when you go to a supermarket of a brand you don't know, with a layout you don't know, and all sorts of foods you don't know. They had a whole section in the freezer just for pierogies. I was like, really confused. You know what a pierogi is, Matt?
Yes, I know what a pierogi is. I'm surprised that there is a whole section dedicated to pierogies. I like pierogies. I don't know if I like them to the point where if I owned a grocery store, I would have an entire freezer section for them.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, wow, they really are serious about pierogies here. I mean, some of the stereotypes about Pittsburgh seem to be fairly, like, I would turn around the store, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of kielbasa here. It's like, these people really, really like their pork sausage. It's a big deal here. So, yeah. And then the other big switch was this morning, we looked on the menu, and I asked my son what he wanted, which of the options he wanted to eat, and he wanted pancakes, but they weren't labeled as such. They were labeled as hotcakes. So everything was hotcakes here. So I had to ask around. I'm like, does everybody here call pancakes hotcakes? And they were like, yep, pretty much. And I was like, oh no, I don't know if I can handle this, please. It's weird, man. Yeah. Yeah, things are different here. You just kind of, you know, I guess you just take a couple deep breaths and move on, man.
If you don't mind me asking, what was the name of the grocery store? What's the chain?
Oh, yeah, it's a Pittsburgh chain going back to, like, the 1900s or something like that. It is called Giant Eagle, which also, I don't know, when I moved to Denver and I found out the main grocery store chain there was called King Soopers, S-O-O, P-E-R-S. I thought that was stupid, too. So, you know, like in the Deep South, it's Winn-Dixie, and in California, it's Albertsons and Vaughn's, and it's weird. You go to these places, and the supermarket chains, despite how massive and global and corporate America is, the grocery stores are still kind of local and very specific, to the point that they still have pierogies in the freezer.
Okay, then. Onward. Mark, unfortunately, for the fourth straight game in a row on Saturday, the Colorado Rapids were defeated. They lose 2-1 to the New York Red Bulls. Just 5 minutes in, Daniel Royer scores in off of a throw-in. Bradley Wright Phillips with a nice little dink around the backside of the defense to the touchline. Nobody picks up Royer. Nobody picks up the low cross into the six-yard box, and Daniel Royer has a pretty much an open tap-in into the back of the net. The Rapids proceed to play, I think, a relatively good rest of the half, as Anthony Hudson said post-game, that there was only one team in it in terms of style of play and attacking. I thought Aaron Long and Tim Parker and Luis Robles were very heroic throughout the latter stages of the first half and through onto the second half in terms of keeping that clean sheet for the New York Red Bulls. I'm sure we will talk about this, but then Derek Etienne Jr. with a goal off the bench in very, very controversial VAR fashion. The official initially puts up the flag for offsides. Etienne Jr. proceeds to run in and score. Then the whistle happens. Then the play is stopped. Ishmael Elfath, the head official, goes to VAR in terms of signaling that they are reviewing it, but chooses not to go to the monitor, as you prefer to troll the interwebs on Sunday morning. Baldomero Toledo, of all people, was the VAR for this game, and ultimately they end up overturning it. That was in the 76th minute, giving the New York Red Bulls a 2-0 advantage, and then off of a rebound that Luis Robles was unable to gather, Jack McBean ends up getting a tap in the 85th minute. That is his first goal in burgundy and blue. In typical Rapids are down a goal at home and they're trying to create something. The other team is scrambling and running out of gas because they're playing at altitude for the first time in a while. The Rapids have a very frantic and frenetic final 10 minutes. There are shouts for a handball with a cross into Joe Mason. There were shouts for a PK with Tommy Smith going down in the box. All to no avail for Ishmael Elfath. The Rapids get nothing done, and unfortunately, the Rapids are defeated 2-1. Four straight loss marks, second straight at home. What was your good thing of all things from this match?
The good thing for me, I think I've been a little bit critical of Edgar Castillo, and Edgar Castillo, along with Sam Nicholson down the left wing, created a ton of attempts and opportunities. I think they had together something like 5 or 6 dribbles, and they created 3 or 4 really good challenging shots. They basically made Michael Murillo's day hell at right back for the Red Bulls, and I thought that was really impressive. And to add to that was Sam Nicholson. I thought they both looked really, really good. And I think those are hopeful things to say. You know, I think it's easy for us, especially because we're both writers and we're also both fans, to be uncomfortable with the new players that have been brought in this year and to be like questioning whether they're worthy of being on our fair team and, you know, wearing our colors and all that stuff. But, you know, when a guy like Sam Nicholson steps up and just, you know, has a lot of really nice dribbles, you got to say, like, the guy is a potential game changer who can do things. I mean, he didn't have the final product, which how many times have we said that as fans and as writers, you know, like the final product wasn't there. You know, they couldn't find the net in the first half, but you know, hopefully it'll come. What was your good thing, Matt?
I'm going to completely agree with you, everything on Sam Nicholson. I think he's the closest thing this team has to a number 10, at least based on what we've seen from the midfield so far. I'll get into other midfield movement and passing sequences when we get to our big thing. But I thought he was very impressive in his second straight start for the Rapids and his first game at altitude. I thought he and Edgar cutting down that side. I thought Nicholson was really a chance creator and a facilitator of the ball in the ways that we haven't really seen from the rest of the midfield this season. And I was impressed, you know, obviously it was disappointing to ultimately see the team lose, but to see them have a response, I felt like, you know, immediately and throughout the rest of the first half, there was a response to New York Red Bulls getting their first goal. There was a response in the second half and there was an uptick, after the Derek Etienne goal, you know, so it was nice to see that response when previously we've kind of seen the Rapids, you know, kind of, you know, have exponential decay, especially after they score first in a game, to see that there was a response and there was a sense of urgency. You know, we've talked about the team sort of dropping off in terms of not sticking to the game plan. If anything, I thought the team ramped up to the game plan. It was just disappointing that it maybe wasn't there in the focus in the first 5 minutes when the Red Bulls, you know, get out one goal of the good, and then certainly, you know, we can talk about you know, the second goal that they scored, but it was nice to see that kind of a response and that kind of resiliency, even if it didn't result in a chance, so to speak, that there was a sense of urgency in ways that we haven't seen from the Rapids, or in ways in which, you know, they're maybe managing a game up a goal and then they give up a goal and then it's hard for them to sort of change gears. This team hit fourth gear pretty quickly after going down 2 goals and hit, you know, was in the third and fourth, I thought, after the first one. So it was nice to see that kind of response when previously, regardless of who's scoring, we see the Rapids maybe drop down in intensity a little bit. Mark, there were a lot of bad things from this game. What was your bad thing?
For me, it was that I always used to say that Ishmael Elfath was my favorite referee, and now he's not. I have to go and find a new favorite referee, although Armando Villarreal is a guy I like a lot, but I also think he has a really cool haircut. Yeah, I mean, the challenge for me with the refereeing, obviously there were three calls that were questionable. The first was the offside that was overturned by VAR. The question being, and I wrote a lot about this, and I'm sure you did too, a question being, A, was it offside? And B, was it clear and obvious enough to warrant overturning? One Twitter commenter was telling me was that according to MLS, clear and obvious when it comes to offside overturning the call is, at least the way he described it, it's a binary system, right? It's either it's offside or it's not. And if the VAR determines that it is off, that it is onside when the AR determined that it was off, then it overturns it. Whether that is, there is no such thing, I think, with offside as like kind of unclear. And, but for me, I don't understand that because it's really difficult to draw a line from the ball all the way to the potentially onside or offside player and then draw the line in such a way that you can tell, well, it only goes through, it doesn't go through his shoulder, and it doesn't go through his knee, and his head is basically, like, it's really, I think these things are subjective based on the angle of wherever the camera is, and the moment at which you decide that the ball is struck by the foot. I think it's very difficult. And for me, it was not clear and obvious at all that he was onside. Everybody who I talked to, without drawing a magic line on the page, said that looks like it's offside. It looked off, like the AR called it. Anyways, long story short, the bad thing about this was that the Rapids looked about equal to the Red Bulls, and they still didn't get a result. Now, in the long run, that happens, you know? You're going to play 34 matches, and in some of those matches, you're going to get robbed. And in some, you're going to get a lucky call, and it's going to break your way. And I think potentially over time, it's supposed to even out. The problem is, in a run when you've already lost three games in a row, it feels really, really bad. So the refereeing was the bad thing for me. On top of that, there were the two other calls that didn't happen, which was Tommy Smith got knocked out of the box and no penalty was called, and there was a handball in the box. I kind of missed that moment, but everybody, you know, screamed that there was a handball in the box, and the referee, Ismail Elfap, did not call it. So refereeing is the bad thing. And by the way, I never criticize referees, ever. I generally think that if you can't win the game on your own merits, you don't deserve it. No matter how many crappy calls you get from the ref, no matter how unfair you think the game is, you have the ball, you have defenders, you need to score more goals than the other guy, period. Point blank, no excuses. But today just felt like, or this game just felt like a game where we were equal to the Red Bulls and the referees kind of jobbed us out of the game.
I'm going to agree with you on that, Mark. I think my biggest criticisms of VAR is, or VAR, excuse me. I don't know if people say VAR or don't, but in any case, I was not expecting VAR to come in and solve all of their problems. And even with video assistant referees and the access to that technology, we were still having arguments about that. I can't remember. I want to say it was you. I think the fact that there was so much controversy about this on Twitter, and I know the comment threads on Andrew Wiebe from MLSsoccer.com's thread, you know, went in, and there was I can never remember this account, and I always feel bad because every time I reference it, I don't remember it. There's a guy on Twitter who knows the dimensions and the camera angles for all the stadiums in MLS, and then he's able to actually do the geometry with a mathematical model to determine whether or not players are offside. So I remember, and then there he has a statistical error percentage. So for example, on Zlatan's fourth goal in the first ever El Trafico, his header goal that was supposedly offside based on the camera angle, he said it was too close to call, but if he had to guess, he was onside. I do not remember what the determination was based on the tweet that he sent out regarding Derek Etienne Jr., but I think the fact that there was such a response and so much controversy over it amongst the Twitter followers and people just looking at the screenshot and, you know, is it... You know, for me, it's in that handball range of, you know, just if the ball goes off against the edge of your shoulder, does that count as handball? Where does the shoulder end and where does the actual arm start in terms of Etienne's part of his hand that's potentially offsides? What's his knee doing that? Is it level with the ball? You know, is onside? You know, tie goes to the runner, so to speak. So all of that is very, very confusing for me. And all of that for me has that particular call right in the era where for me, you know, for me, I see it as I would call it if I am subjectively being a referee in that case, I would have called him onside based on the camera angles that we have. But if somebody else were to argue him offside, I completely understand it and I have no complaint. The fact that we're having this conversation, the fact that it took a Twitter account that's specifically run by somebody who uses mathematical models and okay, we know the camera's here and based on where this edge line is, based on how the grass is run and the geometry, this is where the ball is and this is how far the player is based on where he is outside of the box. The fact that that has to be used in order to ultimately determine whether or not he's 4 inches onside and 4 inches offside clearly shows this was not clear and obvious. And so my biggest, so that's my, like, define clear and obvious for me. Is this the NFL's terminology of indisputable video evidence? Is this the NHL's approach where we have a camera angle specifically over the goal that lines up the crossbar with the goal so we know whether or not the puck crosses the line? I don't have a clear and obvious understanding of what the definition of clear and obvious is. And my biggest criticism of VAR hasn't necessarily been some of the decisions, but it's just been how it's been communicated. You know, you have a case where Bolden Mara-Toledo, I want to say this was Atlanta United hosting Vancouver earlier this season, where Kendall Waston was initially given a yellow card, and then it went to VAR, and then ultimately Bolden Mara-Toledo gave Waston a red card. Vancouver goes on to get hammered by Atlanta, as most teams down a man for more than 60 minutes at Mercedes-Benz go. And then afterwards, the disciplinary committee later that week, the following week, rescinded the red card. So you have the disciplinary committee who is supposed to be, you know, the head. They are the small council of pro, for lack of a better term, ultimately decided that a VAR call that was supposed to determine whether not things were clear and obvious was ultimately getting things wrong. And my other big complaint about this one is Elfath, Mark, I don't know if you saw, he never went back to the monitor itself. He was just talking on the headset at or around the center circle with Toledo, possibly the linesman as well, about the overall decision. So my biggest issue in VAR is not necessarily the use of it or how it slows down the game. I do think overall it's been a positive in terms of giving the referees more information. I don't think they're using that information efficiently. If you're going to call it, go over to the monitor and look yourself. Don't just try, you know, you can take an for a call that's going to call a goal or reverse a goal. It's worth the 2 minutes for you to go over to the monitor and look at it 3 or 4 times in slow-mo, slow it down, look at the still frame, so to speak. So then being communicated to everybody in the stadium of that it was being reviewed, what the initial call on the field was, the communication and the execution of VAR has been absolutely abhorrent on a number of different instances, not just involving the Colorado Rapids, and that's really unfortunate. It's not going to affect the United States men's national team, Mark, but there's a bunch of officials who are going to Russia in about a month who it's going to be their first time using VAR, and given how much of a learning curve there was for it in MLS, I don't know how it's going to go over in Russia, and that's really disappointing because I thought this technology was going to really empower referees to give them information that everybody else had and was going to help them making more informed decisions, and I think that they're using and communicating the use of the VAR system very, very poorly. That was a big rant, so I guess just to close out on this, Mark, so we can move on to hopefully happier things, what was your big thing from this match on Saturday?
Well, I just have one last thing, which is from what I understand from one person, you don't actually, the head referee is not obligated to go over to the sideline and watch the video monitor, but that strikes me as odd by itself, because then you're giving the chance to the VAR referee to decide whether the AR, whether the ref, the head referee needs to go over and review it. It's very convoluted and weird to me that if Toledo says it's clearly onside, overturn the call, then Elfath gets to decide, I'm going to listen to Baldomero, as opposed to I'm going to run across the field and look for myself and then overrule Baldomero. I have no idea. It's very weird. What's the big thing? The big thing from this game is that the team needs to start finding ways to win. And that's it. You know, four losses in a row, or at least draw. Taking points is really important. And they need to start figuring that out. And I don't know if it's tactical or if it's based on the lineup. There's a lot of problems, clearly. There are only a couple of spark plugs on the field who look like they've got it together. The team is often feels, especially in the midfield, disjointed. I think the idea behind a 5-3-2 is that the wings provide width to the team and you know, create. But it really feels like we've got dead spots in the middle of the field, that if Price isn't pinging it out to the wings, or if someone isn't making a run, or if we're not going over the top, then there's nothing connecting through the middle of the field. And that's problematic. And it's four games in a row like this. I mean, this game was their best game, but they looked terrible against Orlando, and they looked terrible against RSL. And I forget the other game in between, but they've looked terrible. So the big thing is we need to start, you know, I hate to kind of go back to talking about Mastroeni, but Mastroeni, he wasn't always pretty, but he wanted them to gut out a point or a draw or you know, get a 1-0 lead and hang on to it for dear life. And we're not gutting out anything this year. What do you think, Matt?
Agree with you on that, Mark. I think there's a number of, you know, this isn't one thing, this isn't one player, this isn't one player selection, as much as fans might want to say, oh, it's because Declan Wynn's starting at center back. There are, you know, there are collective failures. These four games have been, one of Arsene Wenger's, main philosophies in football is that, losses are like deaths. And I feel like there have been, these have been deaths by a thousand or at least several dozen cuts, where I think every single player on the field could do something a little bit better. And if they improve that 10%, maybe we're talking about a team that's, you know, won 2 out of 4, or maybe we're talking about a team that's taken points in 4 straight, and something like that. So I agree with you. My big thing, Mark, listeners will know that I've been fascinated with the tactical aspects of the 3-5-2, and I'm getting to a point where I understand the goals, the objectives, and the assignments for the three center backs, what the wing backs are supposed to do. I think if anybody has an easy transition from past formations they've had to Hudson's system, it's been the forwards, because it's just a two-forward system, and most of these forwards, at least the ones I've spoken to, have said they're comfortable in it. The three-man midfield is still somewhat an enigma to me, other than what Jack Price's role is. It seems like the other two and what they're doing and how they fit in with the rest of the system seems very dependent on the personnel in place and the individual matchup that they have going on. As I wrote about in my takeaways piece earlier this week, and I tweeted it out because it was something that I was noticing, obviously we saw pretty clearly that Nicholson was flaring out to the left side, and we saw Enzo Martinez on a number of cases flaring out to his right. And Hudson said a few things that were interesting to me, both post-game on Saturday and a couple times when I've been to training this week, about what he likes from Nana Boateng. And the one thing that I will say about that is when Enzo flares out to the right, he immediately has a release valve in Nana Boateng, but then you kind of saw little spurts where the center midfielders clearing out and the wingbacks were able to combine and kind of exchange whose roles were there. And in some cases, Sam Nicholson was acting as a winger, and in some cases, Enzo Martinez was acting as a winger. And for me, I don't necessarily agree overall with the decision to start Nana Boateng at right wingback, but if you're going to have Enzo do that, it makes sense to have that wingback being able to cut inside and being comfortable in that center midfield role, which I think Nana Boateng is certainly capable of doing, since that's one of his natural positions. And I thought, if you look at the passing charts that they have compared to the games against Orlando, the game against Sporting Kansas City, certainly the Rapids were much better in terms of their positioning, getting the ball, getting it out wide, and then getting it forward into the final third. The problem then that the Rapids had was providing service either in Enzo and Nana on the right, or Nicholson and Castillo on the left, is then there's a gap in the midfield because two of your three midfield guys are already out wide, and Jack Price isn't going to be running headfirst in the middle of the 18. So you only had Yannick Bolli and Joe Mason. I forgot to mention that Dominic Baggi was hurt in warm-ups with his hamstring. We'll get to that from Field 20, folks. And so, you know, that was good in terms of let's get the ball into the final final third, but then you don't have numbers in the middle for service. So then what was, you know, the plan? It seemed like the plan was better in terms of getting the ball to midfield, getting the ball into the final third. How do you ultimately get the ball into the box to then create chances? And I don't know, you know, that action and that decision by Hudson, that tactical approach, was good from getting to B to C. That doesn't get us all the way to G, as in goal, so to speak. So I am still enamored with what this midfield is, what it's supposed to do, and the individual positions. And I think the fact that we've seen so much transition and so much variance in it shows me the team is still working on that as well. Moving on, Mark, the Rapids unfortunately have not caught a break from the MLS schedulers. This Saturday, they will be traveling to Yankee Stadium for just their second ever game against New York City FC at the Bronx. Mark, New York City FC is a very, very good football team. Most recently, they drew LAFC by a 2-2 score. Fans of MLS will, of course, know that they have David Villa, who is scoring at Robbie Keane level paces. They have other very, very good midfields that Patrick Vieira has been able to accumulate in the form of Anton Tinnerholm, Jesus Medina. They have Maxi Morales, who is their big number 10. They have a gradually improving defense. That's kind of been their big crux in their previous existences. They have Sean Johnson, goalkeeper formerly a longtime of the Chicago Fire. This is an absolute juggernaut of a team, and Patrick Vieira has them firing on all cylinders, Mark. And normally Western Conference teams going in for their first or second ever game on that posted stamp of a pitch that I believe is 68 yards by 103 yards. Normally they're going into a slaughterhouse. What do you make of this game, and how do the Rapids try and get something out of this match?
I mean, it's possible to get a point here, but they need to do some things that they haven't really done much of this year, like defend for their lives. I think opening up and being on the attack against New York City FC is borderline suicidal. Alexander Ring is maybe the most... He's not underrated anymore. He's getting talked about a lot, but he might be the best defensive midfielder or one of the best players in Major League Soccer who isn't talked about a lot. Maxi Morales is the smallest guy I've ever seen who wasn't in a circus. I'll just be really, really honest. He's just really, really small. He's like 5'3". And he's phenomenal with the ball. He's like a pocket Giovinco, which is absurd because Giovinco's already a pocket Giovinco. You know, the back line has been fairly good. Tinnerholm had a great game last week, and Ben Sweat is kind of on and off. I've seen him make some really critical errors to give up goals, too. Same with Alexander Callens, who's probably going to be off soon with the Peruvian national team in the World Cup. So there's a lot going on here, but I think they're... If you can hold up, I'm saying something ridiculous, but if the defense can hold up David Villa and they can get out of there with like a 1-1 draw, they'll be all right. But, you know, this team has lots of ways to hit you. Ismail Tajiri Shradi has been just shredding the league. He has just been absolutely phenomenal. Since he joined the team, I never heard of the guy until a couple weeks ago. And then my website around MLS named him player of the week. He has 5 starts. He has 8 games. He has 5 goals and 1 assist on 8 shots. On 8 shots, Matt. I mean, the dude is just banging them in one after another after another. And he's been scoring game winners too. These are not garbage time goals over weak opponents. They're critical moments. And you know, he comes on as a super sub. He'll play as the wing. He can really do a lot of things, and you know, he comes from a league that you don't really hear a lot about, which is the Austrian Bundesliga. You know, it's a pretty, you know, usually the normal trajectory is for an Austrian Bundesliga player to go to a slightly bigger league in Europe, like Belgium or Portugal, and then to get a little cred there, and then move up to one of the big four in Europe. Personally, somebody out there should tweet in about this if they remember, but I can't think of another player from the Austrian Bundesliga who has played in MLS. So, it's I think he's really the, you know, as much as it's fun to watch David Villa because he's amazing, I think Ismael Tajiri-Shradi is probably the guy to watch. Matt, you had a lot to say about NYCFC. Do you think the Rapids can win this game?
I based on their current run of form and just what New York City is able to, I just feel like this is the end of the Rapids absolutely running the gauntlet. You know, I would say the two New Yorks are three of the, I'd say the top five, top four, teams in Major League Soccer right now. Obviously, you know, they had to face Orlando in the mid of their winning streak that, you know, just got ended, you know, against Atlanta over the weekend, so to speak. You know, I just feel like this is them running the gauntlet. And to your point, you know, I agree with what you said about this team is loaded with attacking options, folks. This isn't New York City FC of their first year, their second year, where if you stop David Villa, you're probably okay with all of your other 1v1 matchups they have. You know, you mentioned Tajiri Shardy. This is a team that has Rodney Wallace, Ronald Matsurita, and Tommy Mack on their bench as far as offensive substitutions are concerned. They are not devoid of talent and options. I kind of want to say though, Mark, that maybe playing as, this is going to sound absolutely crazy, and I'm going to try and talk myself and maybe you and the listeners into this, that maybe having to play on the smaller pitch maybe benefits the Rapids a little bit more, simply because I feel like particularly the Rapids center backs, while systematically they may be a good fit, other than Tommy Smith, I don't feel like they have a whole lot of good individual speed or good 1v1 defending. And when you have a big field where there's a lot of space for those guys to get in behind to make runs, you know, have, you know, a lot of space to really get going at speed, there's a lot of net. You know, here there's one of the cases where if there's a goal kick that's hit pretty well and Tommy Smith steps up 10 yards, as opposed to it Dick's Sporting Goods Park, where he's maybe, you know, gone from the center back line into almost to where, you know, into halfway between the center backs and Jack Price. If he goes up 10 yards to try ahead of the ball, he's probably running into Jack Price in the process. So there's a lot less space, which means there's a lot less room for other players to go, so to speak. You know, it's kind of a, if I have to defend just a 5-yard area, there's only so much that you can do, as opposed to if you have this massive field with a lot of wide spaces. Now, on the other side of that, I think that means that the balls are going to go out wide, and the positioning and the run timing for the wingbacks is going to be absolutely critical in that. But I think this provides a unique challenge that might actually benefit the Rapids in terms of their overall individual 1-1 defending. I just think that New York City FC has so much talent that over the course of 90 minutes, they're probably going to get enough opportunities in order to create something. The one thing that I'm kind of interested to see, the Rapids have made a big deal out of set pieces the last couple games, and in particular their execution on set pieces. Jack Price admitted after the game on Saturday that he needs to do a little bit better job with some of the ones that he's mishit. With a field that's only 68 yards wide, folks, keeping in mind the standard for the max wide pitch and the one that DSG Park is at is 75 yards. So you're looking at about 5 yards difference in terms of from corner to the middle of the box. You know, that might make it a little bit easier for the Rapids to go short corners. And just with where that field is, maybe the chaos of how small the space is going to give them a little bit more opportunities on set pieces. I think those are maybe the two things that maybe help the Rapids. I just don't know that this team, with where they're at with the injuries, is going to be able to muster systematically what they need to do in order to keep up with just, I think, the superior talent that New York City FC has offensively in the starting 11 and off the bench.
Yep. Well said.
Is that it, Mark, then?
Yep.
Okay, Mark, let's move to From Field 20. Speaking of really, really small pitches, the Colorado Rapids did some relining of their practice field, Field 20. Mark, and can you guess the what other stadium has the exact dimensions of what the Rapids have been working on this week?
Let's see. Maybe it's one of the fields that they're going to be playing against for the U.S. Open Cup, because they're really, really nervous about maybe playing on a high school field with a lot of rubber. I'm kidding. Yankee Stadium.
Yes, so they've relined that for Yankee Stadium, and they did a lot more ball movement in terms of that small space. It almost kind of reminded me of the 7v7 scrimmages they have on kind of the mini field, so to speak. So that was kind of interesting, and I think that's improved. Injury updates, Mark. It is looking very unlikely that Courtney Ford, Marlon Harrison, and Johan Blomberg were available for this. Johan actually caught a little bit of a stomach bug in the latter half of last week that slowed down, had him out of training and completely away from the team, because, you know, obviously he didn't want to give, they didn't want a team-wide case of everybody throwing up, so to speak. So unfortunately, he is out. That slowed his rehab. Marlon Harrison and Courtney Ford are improving in their rehabs, but they're still probably a week away. That's kind of disappointing, at least just from the timeline standpoint. If my calendar math is correct, folks, we are currently in the 10th week of the reported 8 to 10 weeks that Courtney Ford was supposed to be out. And I want to say, at most, Marlon Harrison was supposed to be out 2 to 4 weeks. I want to say it was actually reported as 2 to 3 weeks. We are now in the 8th week of Marlon Harrison's rehab, Mark. So they are most definitely out for this coming Saturday. I'm not even sure that they're going to travel with the team, but if they're back in training by next Tuesday, I would expect them to be at or very close to being available for the match against the Portland Timbers 2 Saturdays from now on the 26th of May. Skelton Gashi and Stefan Aigner have both been completely in training, and the expectations is that Gashi should be available. Supposedly the Rapids training staff were going to make that decision later today. I was at training today, folks, so I don't know if that decision has been made. And then all of the reports on Dominic Baggi, who was pulled out at the last minute for the game against New York Red Bulls, had a little bit of a hamstring tightening up in the warm-ups. Most of that was precautionary. It's not currently a major injury, but depending on how they handle it from a rehab standpoint and how hard Baggi pushes himself, there's a possibility for it to turn into something more. And Hudson doesn't want to, you know, you don't want to risk him, you know, can we get Baggi for one or two games and then risk losing him for a month or 6 weeks, sort of a thing. So right now I would probably list Gashi and Baggi as questionable, and I would list the other three guys, Ford, Harrison, and Blomberg, as probably out. I think everybody else should be available for selection and fit, so to speak. Mark, do you have any questions for me from Field 20?
I mean, did you see other than the smaller pitch anything interesting that they were working on, or any specific drills that you maybe haven't seen from week to week?
I just saw just everything that they were working on. There was almost how it normally works, at least from a scrimmage standpoint, is the teams will do, you know, the individual passing drills or like the build-up drills, and a lot of times that will scale up to where they're doing something individually or just them and one or two other players. You know, if it's 5-3-2, then obviously there's 7 players involved there, but then, you know, there's sort of a scaling up of doing the 7v7 with the goals moved up to the goal line being normally where the 18-yard box is and the field being shortened, and then normally an expansion to a full pitch in some cases for 11v11 exercises, either build-up, set pieces, what have you. And it seemed, at least for me, Mark, that a lot of their drills were just done. There was no scaling up, so to speak. It's let's immediately go to the dimensions that we're going to be facing on Saturday. So everything that they did was in the context or within the restraints of the dimensions they'll be playing at Yankee Stadium, which I think is a little bit better given how new the team is. You have a lot of players who this is going to be their first time playing at Yankee Stadium. The Rapids did play 2 years ago, I believe. There was Michael Azzero red card in the first half, and the Rapids ended up losing 5-1. I don't put a whole lot of stock in that game, so to speak. One thing that we didn't mention, Mark, Jack Price got a yellow card against the New York Red Bulls, so he will be unavailable due to yellow card accumulation this Saturday. So I would expect Michael Azzero to slot into that. So I think they're ready from a dimension standpoint, as ready as you can be for a team with all the injuries, for as many new pieces they have that are going to be playing their first game on a pitch of that dimension. The one other thing that's going to be really unique that's going to be, I don't know how they're going to figure it out, is remember that they have to sod over part of the infield on one corner of the stadium. That'll be the near side right corner for those of you looking at it from the main TV sideline angle, so to speak. So that's always interesting, at least in my experience with covering some of the USL teams, Mark, where they have to deal with baseball pitches. In often cases, you'll have the outside backs on that particular field will actually switch cleats at halftime. They will have a separate cleat for the I am defending the field that is actually baseball infield dirt covered in pseudo fake, recently laid down sod, some artificial service possibly, and then one for the I'm spending the entire time in what would be, you know, I guess left field or right field into barely the infield of the opposite end, so to speak. So I'm really, really curious to see how do they handle that from the standpoint of maybe that outside center back who has to deal with that surface in the defensive, in the whatever half they're defending that end, and then also the wing back or the forward that's potentially flaring out to that side. How do they handle that? And there's no real way to replicate that unless, you know, the Rapids wanted to spend, you know, a significant chunk of change, you know, tearing up field 20 or one of the other field surfaces. And there's no real way to replicate that, and I don't know how you adjust for that on the fly, you know, while David Villa is breathing down your neck.
They should just ask the Rockies if they can go practice on Coors Field. It probably wouldn't hurt the Rockies that much anyways, since they don't really have a tradition of winning from game to game. The other question I have for you, Matt, after I kind of give my opinion is, so you threw out that you think Michael Azira is going to be the likely guy to stand in for Jack Price, who's off on his fifth yellow. I think it's an interesting call. I wonder who your midfield three is, because if I were to go three, defensively, if you wanted to be careful, you would definitely go with Azira. But if I were to go with what I think Hudson is more inclined to do, it would be to start Gashi with Enzo, and try Enzo as kind of the holding mid, and then have Boateng on the other wing. Now, I know Enzo doesn't really exactly play kind of the deep-lying midfielder, but when he is asked to kind of kill and lie deep, he looks really compelling at it. The other thing is you could put Boateng there and say you're the deep-lying midfielder who sprays long balls. And it gives you a little bit more of an offensive look. It also begs the question, which kind of goes back also to the field 20 thing, is Skelzengashi, you know, 90 minutes match fit? Because I think we will potentially, based on how well he showed in his final minutes against the Red Bulls, a 90-minute match fit, Skelzengashi might be a serious game changer for Colorado. They might be a lot better if they can get him on the field. What do you think? Who do you think is would be your midfield three, and who would be your, if you were projecting what's in Anthony Hudson's head tonight, what's Anthony Hudson's midfield three?
As much time that I spend with him, Mark, you know, I am many moons away from peeling back the onions that is the theoretical physicist that is Anthony Hudson in terms of understanding his brain, so to speak. I am very pragmatic in my approaches to football. Anybody who, you know, wants to talk to me about my FIFA team, as I am trying to get Bradford City promoted into the English Premier League this year on FIFA 13. This is normally a game where I would go in and I would absolutely bunker and hope for a 0-0 draw. So if you're asking what I would do, I'm putting Michael Azira in my six. His job is to make sure Maxi Morales doesn't have any room to work with, or whoever that central midfield player is, if Patrick Vieira ends up trying to hold things up. I would invert the midfield in the sense that I would almost have a six and a defensively minded number eight, and then I'd have Nicholson at the 10 role. I'd probably have him play a little bit more centrally rather than we've kind of seen sort of a box-to-box eight, Jack Price is the holding six, and then sort of the roamer, whether that's Enzo or Nicholson in the last two games. I would have it inverted in having two more defensively minded center mids, and then a more attacking centrally placed midfielder. So I'd go, I would probably go Azira, as I mentioned, at the six. I'd probably go Nana Boateng at the eight. I'd go Nicholson at the 10. If anything happens to any of those guys, regardless of the role, Enzo's probably my midfielder. And if it isn't obvious based on that with the wing back situation, I'd probably have Dylan Serna at right wing back. What do I think is in Anthony Hudson's head? I think we're definitely going to see Nicholson. Definitely in the, I'd say, the most attacking of the central midfield roles. I think Enzo Martinez will be in that game. I'm not sure necessarily what role that he's going to be in. I think the bigger question for me is, given the pitch dimensions and the speed aspect of what Nana Boateng would be at the wide position and what he's going to face with an overlapping wingback with one of the speedy wingers that NYCFC has, do you have him or do you have Dylan Serna and tell Dylan Serna that his main job is to hold serve defensively? I think that's the question that I think unlocks all of the other answers or automatically dictates what the other assignments are going to be as far as what Hudson's going to be. That's my question. Is Nana Boateng as a wingback, what's his role in that, so to speak? That would be my approach to trying to figure out what the heck is going on in Anthony Hudson's head right now.
I'll add one more thing, which is something that I don't fully understand. My understanding is that Declan Wynn used to play out wide, and this year he has only played as one of the three center backs. I think if you want a really good defensive look, bringing Axel Schoberg back in to that middle three and pushing Declan Wynn out as your right back is a really good idea. I don't know why we don't see that, but you know.
Do you in that scenario? Do you move Danny Wilson to right center back?
I don't. You know what? I don't really care which of the three center backs is playing which spot, because the way the system works with the 5-3-2, it kind of doesn't matter. All three of them spray the ball, and one of the three of them will come up and attack. And everybody knows that when Axel Schoberg is on the field, he's going to be the claiming aerial guy at midfield. He always comes up to the middle of the field just because he's the tallest guy. Just like, you know, when you have a lot of tall guys and you have a lot of fast guys on corners, you put your tall guys, whatever position they're in for the corner, and you put your fast guys way back, you know. Maxi Morales will probably not be in there on headers. So, and, back to our previously scheduled program.
Okay, I think that does it for us for From Field 20, Mark. It is time to move on to Ask HTHL. I do want to send out an apology to Jeff Kazmir. Jeff, you sent out an Ask HTHL, I believe, 2 weeks ago that initially we were holding back on, that I sent out a tweet saying that we were going to respond to you, and then Mark was super late. As of recording, Mark, you have responded. So, Jeff, if you, by the time you're listening to this, I will have responded personally from my individual Twitter account to that original question. We'll be addressing your question that we got yesterday, 2 days ago. Right now. But first, David Ellenberger, Mark, is asking us, my question is, how much potential moolah could the Rapids be spending on a DP this summer window?
How much money? Well, you have the best sense of it because you did, and we'll get into this. You did all the back of the envelope, the front of the envelope math to figure out how much money the Rapids have left for the transfer window. But I think that the kind of biggest thing out of that is that the Rapids have, it's, Matt, it's $1.2 million in discretionary CAM, is that correct, overall?
It's $1.2 million in, I guess, general TAM, league TAM that they're given on. That's for this year and next year. And then it's 2.8 in discretionary TAM for 2017 and 2018. So, Mark, I guess I'll just plug it now. But I did a – if you guys want a headache or absolutely love math, head on over to lastwordonsoccer.com. And I did a bunch of back-of-the-envelope calculations, some scouting, some guesstimations, and a few other things to essentially determine how much TAM and GAM the Rapids have spent. Based on my middle-of-the-road estimation, I think the Rapids are significantly into the 2.8 in discretionary TAM. They've absolutely, I don't see a scenario where they haven't used all of the 1.2 in 2017 TAM that Don Garber gave Paulrick Smith. They're into the TAM, and they've spent a pretty solid amount of GAM that I was not expecting overall, Mark. A lot of that on potential, subsidizing the cap situations, and a lot in acquiring other assets. So to answer your question directly, I don't know how much GAM the Rapids have left in the bank in terms of that situation. Obviously, you can't use TAM to acquire a DP, so I'm not sure how much they could get in terms of a transfer fee, so to speak, David. I think they'd have to dip further into the purse strings as far as GAM is concerned, or use some other TAM to acquire some extra money. So I don't know how much money they could actually be spending. I think my bigger question, Mark, is what position the Rapids are potentially spending at. You know, they've got a lot of really good depth at center back. I don't know that you'd be spending, you know, given what Hudson said about Edgar Castillo and Marlon Hairston, and what we've seen from Dylan Cerna. I think they're okay from a wing back standpoint. I guess the one thing, you know, again, going back to my question of, I don't know what the midfield is. Maybe there's a role in there, potentially a number eight, potentially a pure actual number 10, not a winger masquerading as a 10 or a forward masquerading as a 10, then maybe that's the main hole that you fill. But then how do the Rapids go about filling that, and how does the Rapids going for that in a post-World Cup market affect their ability to spend or how much they want to spend or just the supply of potential players available. I think that's my bigger question for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been waiting 3 years for the Rapids to get a legitimate number 10.
Yeah.
And I've given, like, I just don't think it's going to happen. And the other piece is the big elephant in the room for Colorado is they have a third DP slot that's open, and that they haven't used. So the question, I think the question really is not how much are they going to spend at the next window. It's one, does the team think that spending at this window is really about 2018 or 2019? Because I think a lot of teams are going to be trying to buy that player that gets them over the hump in the playoffs. I think a team like Toronto or NYCFC or Atlanta will try and spend whatever money they have left to get themselves the cup. For Colorado, it's probably, you know, it's either can we sneak into the sixth playoff spot with a good end of season push, or who's the guy we need for next season desperately? And that has to do with a lot of intricate, less so about money and more so about who the team knows there isn't coming back or suspects isn't coming back or who the team thinks needs a big upgrade over. So it's a really, I'm with you that I think it's a midfielder. I don't think it's a 10. I think it's 2 8s personally. I think the team is basically essentially functioning with a 6 and 2 8s. And I think they need an upgrade at the 8. They need a, and I'm going to throw out a name because he's a prototype, but not because he's actually the guy. They need a Jack Wilshere type player.
Yeah.
A quick, nimble, extremely technical two-way player. They are not going to get Jack Wilshere, but you know, a parallel guy who's younger and similar are two Americans who one who isn't getting time and his team is I think just been relegated, and another one who's disappeared off the face of the earth. Emerson Heinemann and Gideon Zalala are two really good players who are both young. They both play in England, so they have that going for them, and they both also have, they're both American, so they don't cost you an international slot. They might come overpriced because they're so good, but those would be two players that I think the team should highlight. Because the other options are basically, you know, one of the common things that you would do at this window, you're trying to get over the hump, is drop a lot of coin on an overpriced older player, you know, a Sebastian Letou kind of player, or a Caseru, Claudiu Caseru, the Romanian international, or a Didier Drogba, you know, like, so that's kind of where we're at. It's less for me about, I used to do the articles that Matt used to do, where I did the math really, really intricately to figure out, can they afford it anymore? I no longer bother because of the new discretionary TAM rules and the ability to pull money forward from a future year. At this point, it's about what is the team trying to go for? And like you said, Matt, where are the holes in the lineup? So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we didn't really answer your question directly, David. I won't get into it now, but I think that there are financial incentives to not having your third DP. I think to your question of are the Rapids going to do something big in the summer window, I think it's a wait and see where they're at, evaluating the existing assets they have. As we talked about last show, I think there's going to have to be some form of resolution regarding Stefan Aigner's situation. I think from then there they'll go from it. I do think if the Rapids do make a splash, I think they're more likely to do it in the form of using all of however much TAM they have left rather than signing a third DP just because of the financial incentives and the way that TAM is working. Just given, and that's more a function of how much GAM they've already spent in other areas, so to speak. So, you know, obviously a DP, they can't use TAM on him. So if there's a transfer fee, if there's a salary, all of that has to come in the form of general allocation money and budget cap space, which I think the Rapids have used up a significant amount of their sources, given that based on my analysis and the analysis of others, they're willing to go into the discretionary TAM space. Maybe they're willing to go all the way for that for the right piece rather than using that third DP slot. Moving on, this is from the rare mid-budget adult. What is he is a long, the rare midget adult, the rare mid-budget adult drama at E Kualung, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, asks us, Mark, what's been Porig Smith's best acquisition? My opinion, he still doesn't have a true quote-unquote hit. Our number 10 spot on the salary list seems very incongruent with our on-the-field performance. That's number 10 in terms of, I believe that's number 10 in terms of the Rapids have the 10th highest payroll for 2018, not referring to the number 10, the type of player. So our being number 10 in salary budget seems very incongruent with our on-the-field performance. He should be feeling the pressure, open parentheses, lol, if anyone at KSC is paying attention, and close parentheses. Mark, what is Pondrick Smith's biggest acquisition? How do you feel about the performance to salary ratio? And I guess reading between the lines, is Porrick Smith potentially on the hot seat, or is there pressure on him to get this team to perform?
I think Porrick's got at least another year of the team performing below expectation before anybody, being a GM is a long-term project, and it's also highly affected by injury. So if you have a lot of injured players, like Skelzengashi last year, Marlon Hairston this year, you get a little bit of leeway. I also think it just takes years. It takes a long time. And, Porik's been with the team, I think, 3 years now, 2.5. So it's still a work in progress. His best acquisition, right now looks like Jack Price. Jack Price really at 400,000, I want to get it exactly right. 407,499.96, which, by the way, I'm doing an interview next week with Fran Taylor, who's the assistant GM of the Rapids. One of the questions I'm going to ask is, why do so many Rapids players get 96 cents and other players get 4 cents? It's been years I've been wondering, and I don't understand it. Anyways, but point being, Jack Price is a really good bargain, and he's been a very good player, and he's been very successful. Another thing that Porrick Smith doesn't get credit for is that he is part of the team that evaluates players who are coming through the MLS Super Draft. I don't think he gets enough credit for the fact that Colorado does quite well in the Super Draft every year. Pulling a Nicky Jackson out of the draft is a really good pull. So that's a nice little addition. Matt, do you have a favorite Porrick Smith acquisition? Maybe going back beyond this year?
Well, I'd say everything for this year, I think for me right now, is to be determined. I think ultimately, by the end of the 2018 MLS season, I think Porrick Smith's best acquisition of his time as general manager is going to be a player who's been acquired between the end of last season and sometime during this season. I absolutely agree with you that I think given the salary price, and we'll talk about this a little bit when we get to our Freakonomics Capology segment. I think getting Jack Price for the number that they got was certainly a good acquisition. There are a number of statistics and eye observations that I really, really like about Tommy Smith. I think one thing, not that this was an acquisition that maybe Porrick doesn't also get a whole lot of credit, is he kind of came in under previous leadership that kind of had the Rapids hamstrung just with a bunch of other bad deals or things that didn't work out, whether it was the Juan Ramilez situation, the Gabby Torres situation. I thought Porrick did a pretty decent job in terms of getting those to a resolution to the point where going into this past offseason, he had a clean slate in terms of players not being on the books who were counting against things, any other sorts of bad contracts that the club was dealing with, Flavio Torres being, an out of shape DP, just in terms of, not having to, how you would have it with other, say other leagues, when a basketball team or an NHL team gets into a case with a bunch of bad situations and they essentially have to spend 3 or 4 years being bad because they had a bunch of really good contracts and then those players got old. I thought he did a really good job in terms of getting the Rapids to, the phrase for that term is teams having to take their medicine or digging themselves out of the holes. I thought he did a really good job of getting out of that. That said, I would agree he hasn't had a hit in the same way that, probably no MLS fan had probably heard of Sebastian Giovinco before he got signed by Toronto FC. I don't think he has, a situation like you know, Grelladinho was with the New York Red Bulls, or another player that was, you know, a minimum wage budget, somebody who was on a really good salary deal, you know, a DP or a young DP who's nobody ever heard of, you know, all of these South Americans. Nobody had heard of Mauro Diaz before Oscar Pereja said his name. And for the money that they're paying him, he's probably one of the most productive DPs who was not born on the European continent and is under the age of, I think Mauro's 24, 25 now, so, you know, 25 or under, so to speak. I don't think he has one of those home run acquisitions yet. I think there's been a lot of other environmental things that have kind of been impacting him, so to speak. That said, to answer your question, the rare mid-budget adults, I think that by the end of 2018, we will have a clear and obvious answer to that question, and that will be a positive thing to look at and saying, oh, Pork did a really good job finding this guy and getting him to MLS, getting him to the Rapids for X amount of dollars.
I want to add one correction and two players. One is, so I looked and Porik joined the team in November of 2014. So he's been with the team for 3.5 years. He's only been the GM, obviously, for about 2 of those years. But I know for a fact that he was very involved in doing the math and the metrics and the evaluation that led to the signings of other players. A couple of those players that Porik was instrumental in kind of pushing the team to sign, Sam Cronin and Michael Azira. So two players those are two other big hits that Colorado had. Obviously, Cronin not with the team anymore and Azira kind of on the bench in a defensive role. But, you know, when he wants to get it, he gets it. And the last one, because I'm totally biased because I thought it was a great acquisition because I predicted it, was Jermaine Jones. So he was very involved in getting Jermaine Jones. So, Porks makes sense.
Moving on, Mark. This is coming from Jeff Casimir, one of our favorites. Assuming everyone is fit and healthy, based on what you know right now, who are your two preferred two starters up top? So your preferred two strikers. And he said include Gashi and Eigner in the pool. So I guess having Gashi and Eigner both fully fit and able to play 90 minutes at altitude. Mark, I'm going to augment this to say what is our two preferred strikers, and then what we also think Hudson's hierarchy is concerned. So Mark, everybody's healthy, everybody's fit. The Rapids are playing in MLS Cup tomorrow. If they win MLS Cup, you live. If they lose MLS Cup, you die. Who's starting up top for you? And who do you think Anthony Hudson's starting in those situations?
If it's life or death, I would put Dominic Baggi at the up top and play Skelzengashi underneath. If I'm playing 5 or 10 games, then I would move Gashi into the midfield and get Yannick Bolli on the field as the underneath guy, or Baggi as the underneath guy. And it's not because I've seen Bolli do anything this year, it's because we've all seen the highlight film of what he's done in past years. We can get the Yannick Bolli who scored, you know, double-digit goals in China and double-digit goals in Russia, double-digit goals way back in his days in France, then that's what I want. But it will be really a bummer if what we see is the player that we get who's totally, completely out of gas, who's just got nothing left, which is, you know, that's the fear that I'm starting to have about Yannick Bolli, that we're getting the husk, the desiccated corpse of Yannick Bolli instead of an actual player. Who's your two, Matt?
So I'm gonna, I guess the, you know, one game to save my life, I think it's hard to not have Dominic Baggi given what he's done so far in the season. I would have Skelzengashi is my number underneath striker. The difference there for me, haven't been super over the moon with the service that Jack Price and others have given on corners, so to speak. I think part of also having Gashi in there as my secondary striker is just to get him on the field, because I want him taking all of my set pieces from both ends of the corners, whether it's an in-swinger or an out-swinger. And right now, I don't feel like, you know, you get a set-piece opportunity, say, 7 to 15 yards outside the box. I don't know that the Rapids really have anybody who's a true threat. We know what Skelzengashi is able to do from those ranges, so I would have those two. I would augment to say if I had to pick a number 10-ish or an attacking-ish midfielder, I think it would be Stefan Eigner for me. If I'm answering what do I think Anthony Hudson has, or what do I think the ultimate goal? I think the ultimate goal for Hudson, I think, is to have Yannick Bolli in the up top channel running number nine role, essentially what Baji's been for the team for most of this season. I think the first choice underneath striker for him is probably Joe Mason. And I think that attacking midfielder role, who maybe was a previous forward, like you said, Mark, is probably Skelshen Gashi going into the midfield for Hudson. I've been hesitant to say this, and I know you said it, Mark. I am creeping my hand towards the button that is pushing a drafted tweet that I have saved in draft saying, I don't think Stefan Aigner is ever stepping on the field for the Colorado Rapids again. I am not at that point right now. I am increasingly starting to feel that way. I just don't know. And to answer your question directly, Jeff, I don't know that Hudson sees that happening, regardless of what you and I think, Mark, or what would we do if we were suddenly named supreme leader of the Colorado Rapids?
I mean, and now we're getting into the real, real stuff, which is there have been, I got a piece of inside information that Stefan Aigner was shopped to other MLS teams before the window closed for transfers in for MLS teams on May 1st. That was confirmed to me by a person who knows of such things in the national soccer media. And then the other stuff is the question of, whether this talk about Anthony Hudson being on the short list for Sunderland is legitimate. Matt's making a face like, I don't know, this seems like bogus. I don't know, it's very weird. It seems, I've never heard of whatever it was, like the North Coast Owl Post or something like that from up in England. But, you know, it seems to have legs, and I don't think, he certainly did not, when asked by you and by Marco Cummings, Matt, Anthony Hudson did not deny it. He didn't say, nobody from Sunderland has called me, and I'm not in the running, and I would never leave the Colorado Rapids, who I love dearly. Right? Like, that would be insane to say, but he didn't say it. So I'm gonna say something really incendiary and crazy, right? The only possibility I can see for Stefan Aigner to get on the field, in the second half of the season and for everything to be hunky-dory for him and the Rapids is if Anthony Hudson actually winds up being the guy who leaves the Colorado Rapids. And I think that both of those are low probabilities, but they're not impossible. I think Anthony Hudson in Sunderland or Stefan Aigner to a team in Kuala Lumpur are both possible.
Wrote an article following up on Anthony Hudson's comments from Tuesday in training, folks. Check that out on lastwordonsoccer.com. Regardless of what the Sunderland's coaching search firm is saying, this is on multiple, regardless of whether or not it's true, regardless of whether or not he is a favorite or one of the finalist candidates for the position at the Stadium of Lights, there are so many aspects of that just don't pass the smell test for me in terms of it actually happening, in terms of Hudson being the final candidate for it. And How do I approach this, Mark? Mark, how familiar are you with the various superhero movies that have come out, and like the fact that like the Justice League reboot was absolutely terrible, and like Avengers has been killing it for years and years now, including Infinity Wars?
I've been familiar with the fact that all those things you said are things that people have said.
Okay, I just like this for me is Nick Fury forming the Avengers and then getting an offer to join the Justice League after the Justice League movie that had just happened, and then choosing to jump ship. So, you know, if you want to make the argument that, oh, maybe Sunderland can pay him five times what the Rapids are paying him from a coaching salary standpoint, okay, maybe you have an argument. If Hudson ultimately has aspirations of playing in Europe and going to Sunderland, getting them promoted back into the championship, then allows him to go to job A, to job B, to job C, to job D, to then potentially coaching a Real Madrid, a Chelsea, or something like that, then I can understand it. But there's just Sunderland in many ways is a sinking ship. Other than parachute payments, I don't see what they have going for them going into League One. And normally the first thing that a coach that had previously coached internationally that then transitions into club coaching does is immediately assemble their guys. Bob Bradley went from the Egyptian national team to coaching Stabæk. He started getting getting some of his past guys. We've seen him do that with LAFC, bringing in an Egyptian in Omar Gaber, and then also a couple guys that he's coached throughout his time in Europe, so to speak. One of the first things that Bruce Arena does when he coached the U.S. men's national team, brought in Sebastian Legette, Omar Gonzalez, Matt Beisler, guys who were his guys who were his guys when they were young, when he was coaching the national team before, guys who he liked from MLS before. Anthony Hudson's already done that, and let's say that he does spurn, you know, does burn the Rapids and ultimately go to Sunderland. Have fun trying to get a remotely reasonable market value transfer fee for Tommy Smith in the summer transfer window from the Rapids to Sunderland or any of the other players that he's accumulated. Just the timing of it doesn't make sense to me. All of those make it not pass the smell test, regardless of the reports coming out of Sunderland. I'm not going to address it any further. This has been a headache for me.
One more thing, which is just like, why would you go from a job where you almost certainly have at least a year and a half of job security with the Rapids, at least a year anyways, to a job in England where you have like zero job security? I mean, they go through...
Sunderland had three managers this past club season.
Almost all English teams go through managers like they go through disposable diapers. I mean, you know, it's I am personally, and this is a bit of a rant off topic, but not really, I'm like almost offended at how quickly managers get sacked in specifically in the top two or three English leagues. It boggles the mind. Bob Bradley didn't have five freaking minutes to assemble a team. He was there 85 days, right?
And did not have, and was not there for any overlap with the transfer window. So he had no chance to make any moves to bring in guys he liked or got rid of players who did not fit what he wanted to do.
Anybody who's had a new job knows that, like, it takes you a freaking week to figure out how to work the copier, you know? It takes you 3 weeks to learn four people's names who you need to know. Like, it takes a long time to adjust. And managers in England get no time. Why would you want, no matter how much money or prestige comes with the job, why would you want to jump to a position where basically you're sticking your head under the guillotine on day one? You're just hoping you can last one freaking season and then you can use it to burnish your resume. I mean, like, there's the alternate to that, right? David Moyes, his reputation is trashed, right? He failed at Man U. He failed at, I think, Villarreal. And then he's failed out now in bringing Sunderland to absolute rack and ruin.
Mark, he's back at West Ham. Like his accomplishment from his last four coaching jobs is having West Ham finish their season without the Iron supporters burning down the Olympic Stadium.
This is
the biggest accomplishment on David Moyes from his last four coaching jobs, folks. And like, and he is average as far as the meat grinder that is the Premier League and the Championship and League One, grinding out coaches and spitting them out like chop suey.
Yeah. I was just going to add, and this is almost a political statement, but not really. It's a familiar axiom for a lot of people that white men fail up. You know, that you could suck at your job and like actually get a better job after you get fired. And this only happens with white males. The rest of society doesn't get second chances like this. David Moyes, go home. Quit. Anyways, all right.
Moving on, listeners, I know Mark and I had hyped our doing a big Capology segment. One of the plights of being a podcaster is oftentimes you do a podcast, you know, on a weekly-ish basis, and then something comes out, you know, later that day. Maybe you get breaking news right after you're done recording and you just put it out, or you have something like that, you know, happen the day after. Mark, unfortunately, the timing was good for us in a number of respects. Last week, we unfortunately potted, you know, within 24 hours of the salary cap information coming out. So a lot of this information is kind of old in the sense of it being regurgitated. Myself and other members of the Rapids Press Corps have gone over all of the various cap numbers and everything. So I report you to, you know, Marco Cummings' work, the article, a really long article that I wrote for Last Word on Soccer.com. Mark, I don't know offhand if you wrote anything cap related, for around MLS. Okay. So I would, I would refer you to all of those stuff. Obviously, the player salaries are out, so we're just going to do a quick overcap thing, and I would say if there's anything regarding Capology or the cap situation with the Rapids that you would like to engage us on, feel free to hit us up in person. Feel free to hit us up on Twitter, and we'd be happy to continue that conversation. This episode's already going way longer than it probably should, so we're going to keep it brief. So, we'll start with just a general overview, Mark. Name a couple of players who you have, you feel, based on performance, are overpaid as far as the Colorado Rapids are concerned.
Well, there's no doubt that Yannick Bolli is probably the most eye-popping, with $907,000 a year, and he's not quite fit yet. But if he can start doing stuff, it's a decent gamble. Joe Mason is a bit of a surprise to me at almost $700,000. He's making $682,500. And you know, you bring in Joe Mason, he's on a loan, so we're not exactly sure who's paying all of it. My assumption is the Rapids are playing at least most of it. They may even be playing all of it. But the question becomes, like, all right, so now you have a very strong striker in Dominic Baggi, and you brought in two fairly expensive strikers to go with them. So that's a bit of an oddball. The other ones the other big take that I have, I think, is a global comment about MLS, which is 200,000 is the new 100,000.
Yeah.
Or even 300,000 is the new 200,000. There was a time when a player who made, and I'm talking like 2 years ago, Matt, a player who made $200,000 in MLS was
had to be a starter.
Yeah. They were an eye pop. That was an eye popping number, and you expected that guy to be not only a starter, but a major contributor. Now, you can have a significant number of bench players. Matt, did you catch what the average MLS salary is, MLS roster is, in terms of overall total salary?
The senior players or all players?
All players.
All players? I don't know it. I'm going to guess it's in excess of 250K.
Yeah, that's the average. I meant the total, the whole thing.
So the entire budget, how much all players are getting paid?
Yep.
The entire league?
No, per team, I mean.
Oh, per team? It has to be in excess of 10 million, because the Rapids are right at 11.
It's at 9, so it's a little over 9 million.
Okay.
Because the Rapids are 10, there's 22.
9 million for 30 roster spots, most teams not using all of their roster spots.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, so that's, you know, you divide it up, and that means that the average player in MLS is getting paid more than they used to, but also, like, you can have $200,000 players who are really, you know, like, you're happy that they contribute, but you weren't necessarily expecting it. So for Colorado, that's guys like Johan Blomberg and
Axel
Schoberg, right? Very good. But then you have the $300,000 players who now no longer seem like total busts. It felt to me like Nana Boateng was an extremely expensive player last year. And now, in the context of all the other players that Colorado has, he doesn't look so bad at $361,000. I'm trying to think. There's one or two other players. Sam Nicholson is a little bit expensive at $311,000, but within the realm of expectation, you know, like totally reasonable. So anyways, that's my big takeaway, that those middle class players who used to feel like, well, you really got to contribute because you're making a significant middle six figure income. Now it's like, okay, if you know, the last takeaway I'll have, and then I'll turn it over to you, is I was a little surprised at Andrew Dykstra's number. I can't understand why you need, and I'm quibbling over $40,000 essentially, but I can't understand why you need a $100,000 third string striker.
Especially when your backup is Zach McMath.
Especially when, and I'm biased and you know I am about our academy, but we have a lot of really good academy goalkeepers who probably could have done the job too. And on top of that, we have an affiliation with Charlotte. And in the past, I mean, last year, Cody Mizell came up as our backup goalkeeper when we needed him. You sign a guy to an emergency contract. It doesn't cost very much. So, you know, no offense to Andrew Dykstra, who I'm sure listens to our podcast every week. But I think That's like $40,000 they probably could have spent in the communications department or hiring a few more, maybe spending a little bit more on Burgundy tailgates or maybe even renting taco trucks towards the end of the season for us. Matt, what do you think?
Okay, so first of all, general overpaid players, and I'm going to put asterisks all over this on, you know, I want to reevaluate this at midseason when the summer transfer window opens, and definitely want to reevaluate this at the end of the season. Given what we know, just Stefan Aigner, whether or not it's, because of his problems or with Anthony Hudson, like, fact is your fourth highest paid player has played 11 minutes and doesn't seem to be in any way in the coach's plans in the immediate or, long-term future. Yannick Bolli, for the salary that he's getting, is going to have to come into this team and be a significant contributor, if not be at least the team's highest paid, at least most significant goal scorer. That's pretty much it as far as players who I think are genuinely overpaid. I was a little bit surprised initially as Johan Blomberg's number, but like you said, Mark, you know, I think that, you know, $240,000 you know, in total guaranteed compensation, that's not what it was 2 years ago, and it's definitely not what it was pre-TAM. Players who I think are underplayed, who I think are good values guys. I don't know that this is a big surprise given that he had been playing in USL the last 2 years. But Enzo Martinez is on a senior budget minimum, folks. So given the minutes that they've gotten out of him and the type of player he is getting him for, you know, essentially five figures, I borderline want to say is insulting to the level of effort that Enzo Martinez has given. Really, really surprised with Edgar Castillo's guaranteed compensation, just under 130 grand mark. Now, granted, he is on loan for Monterrey, so I don't know how much of, you know, his Monterrey contract is still in there. And then, not that I'm accusing Edgar of anything, there's a really poorly kept secret in Liga MX that players have two salaries. There's what you need to pay them, what officially needs to be the sticker price in order to appease the league as far as financial fair play is concerned, and then what you pay them under the table in order to get them to come to the league. So there's a possibility that, fairly or unfairly, based on the mechanisms, that Monterrey is still covering some aspect of that, but given that, you know, I would say Edgar Castillo has the potential to be one of the better, you know, wide defensive players in this league, so to speak, and where he is at from an age standpoint, to have him at under 200K, you know, like you were saying, Mark, how the 300,000 is the new 200,000. I would almost say 130 is the new veteran minimum. So I was a little bit surprised at that. Depending on what we see from him, I really like where Sam Nicholson's at with his number, you know, just over 300,000 in total compensation. Moving on, I get into this a lot more in my TAM calculation section, folks, but I was really, really surprised at a couple numbers here with the over-budget players here, Mark. Tommy Smith at just over 640K, Danny Wilson at just over 540K. No mention of TAM in their salary, so I talk a little bit about that in the article. I am absolutely flabbergasted, Mark, that according to what we have, Jack Price is a budget player at, you know, $407,000, $499.96, but TAM was mentioned in his press release, which tells me that all of that was in the transfer fee. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, I think that's potentially the get of 2018 as far as Porik Smith's work is concerned. So that's it as far as the underpaid players. My biggest surprises are probably some of those, and I get into that in more detail in the articles. Any other big takeaways that you have overall, Mark?
The big takeaway is the team is spending money, and as much as some people feel, I'm sure a lot of fans feel like we're not getting much production, especially when the ninth highest spending team on the MLS list is Atlanta United, and they look spectacular, and we're 10th, and we don't look spectacular. You know, it's nice to see the team spending money. There was a time a couple years ago when Colorado, I think it was 2014, when the Rapids were like either the last or the second to last team in Major League Soccer to spend money on a DP. And then, of course, they went out and got the wrong DP and Gabby Torres. But, you know, spending money is good. And if you follow any other sports, you know that sometimes you were going to go out and spend a lot of money and not get production. So it's, you know, live and learn a little bit. And I think it's, you know, if you want more of my thoughts on how the Rapids are spending money, I put my comments on this week's, on the big roster salary dump from the MLS Players Association into Backpass from today. So go check that out.
I'm going to quote retreat you there, Mark. You know, as I get in my article on lastwordonsoccer.com, I was pleasantly shocked with how much GAM roughly the Rapids are probably have spent both on players and then also on just general acquisition of other assets. Been very, very impressed with that. And based on my calculations, and I go into full detail with all the math on my article, there's no way the Rapids are not noteworthily, help me out here, Mark, with my words. Am I speaking English here?
No, you are, noticeably.
Okay, noticeably within the discretionary TAM. So previously, you know, TAM was this big thing, but it was money that the league was essentially giving to you, and it was either spend it or, you know, ultimately it's going to expire and it goes back to the league, so you had no reason not to spend it, either in trading it or using it to acquire players. So that was really free money, so it seemed like a lot of teams that maybe, you know, the New England Revolutions of the world, the Columbus Crews, the DC Uniteds, I'd throw the Rapids in there of past years, you know, were spending money, but it was money the league was giving them. It was free money that either you lose it, you use it, or you lose it. Based on my calculations, they're thoroughly into discretionary TAM. So whether or not they're going to use that third DP slot in the summer transfer window, whether or not they're going to spend big and using that third DP slot, the teams clearly indicated they're willing to spend GAM in order to make moves that give them other options, and they're willing to spend discretionary TAM out of their own pocket. That makes me believe that they're willing to spend discretionary TAM come the summer transfer window in order to try and improve this team to get this right, you know, hashtag the Rapids way, so to speak. Listeners, follow us individually on Twitter at RapidsRabbi and at LWSMattPollard. Follow us collectively on Twitter at Rapids96Podcast. Subscribe to us on any of your favorite podcatchers. Just search for Holding the High Line with Rabbi and Red or Rapids96Podcast. You can email the show at Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com. That's me about 90% of the time, but Mark also has access to that Gmail. I think that, and follow our collective written work on the Colorado Rapids at lastwordonsoccer.com and around MLS respectively. Mark, I'll give you the final word on this. Any closing thoughts before we head on to New York City FC?
Well, right after we get through New York City FC will be an Open Cup game. I think a lot of our listeners are probably Open Cup fans just like we are, but Open Cup is just a blast. It is the hipster chic of the soccer world, you know? There's not as many concession stands open. It's a Wednesday afternoon. It's hard to get to the stadium, but like, these are the best Rapids fans. These are the best supporters. These are the most knowledgeable supporters. It's the best atmosphere. You are excited about the Rapids playing their younger players. You're excited to see a lower league team trying to grind their way out. So, and the tickets are always cheap. They're almost always $10. So, there is nothing bad about the U.S. Open Cup. It is just all gravy. It is all good. And most importantly for me, I think the Rapids have never won the U.S. Open Cup. They can do this. They can do this. Matt, they can do this. They can do this, Matt.
Listeners and Mark, I look forward to eating some of that Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup gravy with you next week, hopefully at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. Listeners, we'll see you then.